There is mention of the town's historical importance as the center of the abolitionist movement in Kansas, noting John Brown and other Jayhawkers who fought to keep Kansas a free state after the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 allowed the citizens of the territory to decide for themselves.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Andrew Malin Millward. His short story collection, I Was a Revolutionary, published by Harper, interrogates historical Kansas from the Civil War to the present through literary fiction and artifacts, including Wikipedia entries, photographs, maps, and satirical cartoons.
I became really interested in how we relate to violence, you know, whether the distance is temporal or whether that distance is geographical.
Exodusters, The Burning of Lawrence, I Was a Revolutionary, and Andrew Malin Millward on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Man came to town, screaming and shouting. He said, I'll save you from that flood coming down from the mountain.
Today, we'll be talking with short story writer Andrew Malin Millward. He is the author of two collections, the Agriculture Hall of Fame, awarded the Juniper Prize for fiction, and his most recent story collection, I Was a Revolutionary.
That's one of the challenges that good fiction requires of both writers and readers, is to make us make those empathic leaps, to put our own heads inside the heads of other people who are maybe very dissimilar from us.
In the first half of the show, we'll listen to and discuss a Civil War tale called The Burning of Lawrence, about Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, Kansas, August 21st, 1863.
Ain't no messiah that can pick up our mess, throwing stones at each other. It's all in a fence, a 9-1 man, I'm gonna save us all.
Short story writer, Andrew Malin Millward, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This river flows through, but it's starting to rise. The walls will not hold, still the people just hide their eyes. From what'll surely fail.
Quote, at daybreak on August 21st, 1863, Lawrence citizens were aroused by the sound of firing and the shouts of guerrilla raiders who swept down on the town from the east, led by the notorious irregular William Clark Quantrill. End quote.
Heaven's on fire.
So would you just tell us the actual story of the burning of Lawrence?
When Kansas was finally made a free state, there was a lot of both organized and unorganized fighting going on. And so there were a group of Confederate guerrillas who weren't officially part of the Southern Army, but were doing guerrilla tactics. And Lawrence had been established as the free state stronghold in Kansas, that center of abolitionism, the symbol of it. And so what happened with this particular event, Quantrill was the Missouri guerrilla who led a group of about 450 of his men into Lawrence and basically massacred as many of the men and boys as they could find.
Heaven's on fire.
Quote, after 4 hours, they withdrew, leaving 150 dead and the major portion of the town in ruins. So futile was the resistance offered by the surprised and terror-stricken citizens that the Quantrill band retired with the loss of only one man. End quote.
That's the thing about history, right? It's not graven, it's points of view. And it seems to me that typifies the points of view that are in this, which include descriptions of photographs and films, songs.
We cross the prairies as
in the photograph from 1912 to taken 49 years after the raid, the remaining men kneel, sit, and stand in wide rows three deep. As I count it, there are nearly 50 in all. The photographer had to move the camera so far back that their expressions are only the ghosts of expressions. You can tell they are hardened, though. Gaunt and weathered, these are faces upon which to break firewood. End quote.
Let's kind of look at it. The story begins with the idea of a reunion. It's called Photograph. And in the photograph from 1912, taken 49 years after the raid, the remaining men kneel, sit, and stand. These men survived the raid, but they weren't survivors of the raid.
Some look as though they might be smiling, others grimacing. By virtue of their posture and positioning of their heads, one gives off an air of pride while his neighbor communicates shame.
You started with this idea of a kind of reunion. Did that happen?
Yeah, it's the way I was able to re-enter the story was looking at this photograph of this picnic of these men. It was so confounding to me that they would get together and commemorate this horrific event. That led me to be interested in what other kind of artifacts are there that touch on the raid or speak to the raid, but that felt like the right way to enter it because there's something that's so haunting about that picture to me.
He's gone blind, getting raised, doing all the same things I did, climbing past you, on the ridge, and boys, and
by this time, they were old men in suits with canes and prickly gray beards. Before the raid, they had been farmers, had survived the bitter fighting of the Civil War, and now they found themselves in a new world, with Europe fixing to blow like a powder keg. How long had it been since they'd seen each other? Whose idea was it to have this strange reunion? Did they speak of the raid? What on earth did they talk about?
So the idea is Lawrence is the center of the abolitionist movement in Kansas, and this group is going to crush that movement.
They're also taking revenge. You know, atrocities were committed on both sides, and the abolitionists had their own guerrilla group called the Jayhawkers, or the Redlegs, and they would lead raids. Northerners, many from Massachusetts, flooded into the territory armed to the teeth, as did pro-slavery Missourians like Quantrill and his raiders, and what followed were years of atrocities on both sides.
The church folks said, Jesus may love you. Deserters, they'll find no friends. That's how the young drifter men.
And interestingly, Quantrill, for a time, he was kind of a, before he became a committed, highly partisan, pro-South, forever the South kind of fighter, he went whichever the way the wind blew.
All wars are civil wars, all men are brothers, what's yours is mine. Mine is yours, and we keep a right on killing each other.
I didn't quite get this into the story as much as I would have liked to, but he actually lived in Lawrence for a time, was a school teacher there, and he would go on these raids that the Jayhawkers would do to free slaves in Missouri. And what he would do is he'd help a slave escape, bring him to Kansas, and then recapture him and return him to Missouri for the money. Cynical opportunism was his political cause for a while.
It'll never end unless we change it, friends.
I'm Jay Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Andrew Malin Millward talk about his short story collection, I Was a Revolutionary, and his story, The Burning of Lawrence.
Sometimes I feel like you were so cruel, like you were so cruel. Like Judas Iscariot and Catherine the Great, Ivan the Terrible and Henry. there's you.
And of course, this is a bit of a strange love story.
Strange is the right word.
I'll walk a million miles in your direction. I stood out in the wind and in the rain. But then you just dismissed me with affection. And you never even called out.
In The Secret Bride, the second part, he's basically courting a 13-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. It's historically true. You know, he was married to Kate, a young 13-year-old girl, and...
Right, and she asked coyly, "How many men have you killed?" "None, my dear. I've never harmed a soul."
Yeah, sometimes I feel like you were so cruel, like you were so cruel.
Part of what struck me as I'd been researching Quantrill is that he never really sees her again after the raid. So yeah, this story kind of parallels these two strange love stories. You know, for all the violence in here, and some of it is pretty gruesome, there's a present day unrequited love story, and there's a past kind of love story between Kate and Quantrill that is requited but is not allowed to flourish. They never really get to see each other. By the time Quantrill's raiders leave Lawrence, Union leaders in Kansas City have finally mobilized forces to intercept the guerrillas before they cross into Missouri, where they'll disappear into brush and thicket, gully and wood, into the very soil and become ghosts.
You do focus here a lot on ghosts.
Yeah, ghosts are throughout this story, but also throughout this book. The ghosts of history are haunting all these characters. The Union forces stage two dramatic attempts to stop the rebels, but ultimately fail. Now it is almost 24 hours after the ambush began, and with a clutch of Union troops shrinking behind him in the distance, Quantrill feels as though he could sleep for a year, maybe two. He knows they'll be safe if they can just make it to Missouri, and he's oppressed by the desire to ride straight to Kate's home and see her face. Amidst all the death has been her memory, the longing to touch her again. Despite this pull, he will take his men to Texas to hide out and let things settle. But as they race for the border, there is so much Quantrill doesn't know. He doesn't know that he'll never receive the recognition he so covets from the Confederate Army. No legitimization of him or his men. No General Quantrill.
We must be gone ere the dawning of day. The Quantrill they seek shall be far, far away.
He doesn't know that months from now, his men will abandon him, either taking up with George Todd or so racked with guilt over their hand in the burning of Lawrence that they can no longer fight, that only a handful of them will follow him to Kentucky with the intention of continuing on to Washington to assassinate Lincoln. He doesn't know that he'll never get the chance. Ambushed by Federals, he will die in Taylorsville, Kentucky, dumped in an idler's grave, farther away from Kate than ever. He doesn't know that it'll be more than 100 years before his body is exhumed and returned to the loam of Missouri, the people there split on whether to celebrate the occasion or protest. What he knows now is only a word containing a desire, a wish of coming home, really. Kate. It is a morning once again, and the last 24 hours have taken on the feeling of whole calendars of time. There in the distance, as he crosses into Missouri, the sun appears in the sky, purple shading into blue, shading into red, forming slowly up over the far-off hills like a blister, a blemish, a birthmark.
Heaven's on fire.
This is the culmination of Bleeding Kansas and this very divisive question of whether Kansas was going to be a free state or slave state. And that question is what launches the Civil War. And I wonder if in some sense the Quantrill story has resonated or kind of fascinated or confounded, in part because it's so central to our American story, that it was part of these events that were happening in Kansas that precipitated our Civil War.
This is Arts and Letters. Let's listen to Andrew Malin Millward's second story, O Death, a post-Civil War tale about Exodusters.
O Death. In that year, the South was redeemed. And with President Hayes having already removed Union troops, something had to be done, for surely nothing good awaited C.K. Howard and his young family with the return of Democrats to office.
Let's talk about this second story, O Death, in a lot of ways similar to the first one, but in other ways very different.
The story is split between two black families. One is part of the founding group from Kentucky that kind of founds the town, and what they have to go through just to survive, to build some kind of infrastructure, essentially. And then the other family are Exodusters from Mississippi.
Tell us about Exodusters.
Yeah, this was one of the stories that, when I started researching just by reading A Simple History of Kansas, I learned the story of the Exodusters, and I thought, how is this not required history in every high school history class? And the story is pretty amazing. It involves the journey of masses of freed people, African Americans, out of southern states after troops were pulled out of the South by President Hayes and Democrats were returning to office, which was very scary for the black population, the question of whether slavery would be reinstituted. And so what happened was this mass migration of people out of the South coming to states, particularly like Kansas,
where they said they're giving away free land.
Right. And, you know, the fact that Kansas had been founded very bloodily as a free state, they thought they'd be well received. And this journey of these folks out of the South was so compelling to me, and what they had to go through just to get there. And then what happens once they got there.
Sentimental journey. I'm gonna set my heart at ease. Gonna take.
It was better than it had been before the war. That strange contradiction of being bound to a master in a slave state that had chosen not to secede.
I got my bags, I got my reservation.
That had somehow fought to preserve the Union. But the thought of their own town seemed a danger even to dream.
In wild anticipation, longing to hear that all aboard.
And so C.K. is the character here, and he pulls this advertisement for a newly established town in Kansas, whose name, he says, was almost familiar, though he'd never once left Mississippi, and the town's name was
Nicodemus. One of the stories that was really compelling to me was the founding of this little town called Nicodemus.
That takes me back. I never thought my heart could be so yearning.
And was it an actual town?
Mm-hmm. It's the oldest still surviving all-black town west of the Mississippi. Part of the research for me in this book was to go to a lot of these places that I didn't know, and Nicodemus was one of them. There's about 26, 27 people still in town. It's the kind of small town that I drove right by and didn't realize I'd passed it. You know, I had to turn around. It's that small. It's still there, and they've turned it into a historical site, but it's an amazing story.
But kind of largely forgotten.
Largely forgotten.
Come and go to that land. Come and go.
There would be talk of Kansas, the Eden on the Prairie, of Pap Singleton and the Negro settlements in Hodgman and Grant counties. Rich black sandy loam, wild horses aplenty, forests of elm, willow, hackberry, and sycamore for building. $5 gets you there by rail and cart. The government was practically giving away land.
I got a savior in that land.
Let's talk about CK, because this journey.
The journey from Mississippi to St. Louis, you know, part of what happens is they're waiting on the river, on the Mississippi.
And the boats,
and
are,
the
going
boats
by.
Are just going by.
Nobody
just
picking
going
them up.
By. No one's picking them up. And finally, one ship captain does. He can't, in good conscience, keep passing up people. And so he picks everyone up. And CK and his group of 100 or so think they're alone in some sense. And they arrive in St. Louis to find so many folks like them who are all migrating. The time it takes to raise money to try and get passage from a boat there to Kansas City, and then from Kansas City to Nicodemus. This is the longest story in the book.
Let's hear about Talman. This guy is already there.
You know, Talman's older. He and his wife, Eugenia, have a child very soon after arriving in Nicodemus, and the birth of their child and the birth of the town seem intertwined in his mind, and their child dies. And, you know, CK finally arrives, someone who's just absolutely destitute because of this journey.
They all come together in this moment of crazy violence.
For all the struggle the town had endured, there'd been little quarreling since settling. A couple of fist fights, one of them a contest between ministers arguing over Bible interpretation.
CK is found in whose house?
Baldwin, the Stone House, who's one of the sort of town fathers, but he has sort of more money than anyone else.
CK is accused of breaking into Baldwin's Stone House, and here we find CK and Baldwin grappling in the dirt as Talman and the rest of Nicodemus look on.
They arrive to take their place in the growing crowd, half circling the stone house. There was an awful commotion of some sort, but Talman couldn't see anything from the back. He stood on his tiptoes, and when that didn't help, he pushed to the front. And that's when he saw the two men wrangling in the dirt, Thomas Baldwin and someone he didn't recognize. They were rolling on the ground, drumming fists into each other's middle, positioning for leverage. And it was as if no one knew what to do, transfixed as they were by the sudden explosion of violence in the calm summer night. The man looked back at the crowd and just sat there as Baldwin regained his wits and started to hit back, repaying the blow a dozen times over. It looked as if he were letting Baldwin hit him, until he finally tipped over and sprawled in the dirt.
He hits Baldwin first, but then Baldwin just beats him nearly to death.
And CK's so ashamed of his anger that he lets himself be beaten. He stops fighting back. Baldwin stood over him and kicked his side. He looked at the crowd and screamed, "He tried to break into my house." He kicked the man again, and the stranger's wife cried, trying to bat away his boot. They're exodusters. You see how they are.
I am on the battlefield.
Absent a word, Talman pushed past the bystanders into the moonlit stretch of dirt where the beaten man and his family lay. Baldwin was possessed of an untethered rage that seemed like it might swing Talman's way. when he stepped between him and the fallen man. The woman's crying had petered out into a hard kind of breathing. She looked at Tallman, her eyes open wide with uncertain expectation. Tallman helped raise the man to his feet.
Tallman finds his mercy.
He finds his grace and his mercy. You know, there's a period in the story after his son dies where he just can't really do anything. His wife tells him, you know, your heart can hurt, but you still got a father. So he just pours himself into work, and he's not really thinking about much. He's happy that work takes all day. CK's arrival is the first moment that he's thinking deeply about his action and his role, and his response is to intercede into this violence and then to care for this stranger and his family.
The ending is just... It's wonderful. And at the same time, it's mysterious. Nothing is truly answered.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's one of the ones in the book I'm proud of. I think there's something interesting really happening between these two guys.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt.
All over Kansas, Tallman thought. Maybe they could care for a family or two, but what would they do if that many people came their way? The town would never survive. He looked around him, again focusing on that smoke, and imagined its haze as the dust kicked up from the feet of 1,000 weary souls, all coming for Nicodemus.
Oh, press so hard, they could not.
In the distance, he watched the smoke rise slowly from those holes in the ground, like signs from the great fire below. Nicodemus, he said, testing whether something would happen. But there was no voice, no vision, no song. Nicodemus, he whispered again, and nothing came. The name meant nothing anymore but this. He felt alone out there in the coming of full dark.
To let my people go.
In Nicodemus, we see the struggle to establish a town where black people can have their own town and businesses and their own land and their own community and the struggles that ensue from that.
Give me something soft like sweet religion.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to songwriters and musicians, Radio Birds, Kelly Deal and Mike Montgomery of Our Ring, Amy Joseph M., Rodney Block, Alvis Diab, The Mallet Brothers, Joseph Emo, Jeff Dempsey, Lady Georgia Hudson, and Tim Anthony for music that conjures up America's past and speaks volumes about its future. Thanks to Adam Simon and Chris Hickey for production work. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Kansas writer Langston Hughes. I have discovered in life that there are ways of getting almost anywhere you want to go, if you really want to go.